Please like, share, and subscribe. Thank you. Hi everyone, this is Gonzo G, just making a video about trans widows. Well, let's go. Yes, friends, here's this documentary that I saw last night about trans widows and their families. Yes, you notice how when the people, they change into their desired sex or whatever. Yeah, they don't talk about what happens to the women and the children in these relationships, how fucked up it is. Yes, this documentary is a feminist documentary, but yeah, the subject matter about the trannies, wow. Yeah, it's stomach turning. Yes, feminism is wrong, but so is the trannyism, or whatever you want to call that crap. But yes, friends, just watch this video and you've been warned, it is a doozy. So yeah, well anyways, enjoy.
I'm 39.
I'm 50 now.
I'm 69.
I'm 44. I'm 38.
I'm 42 now.
I've just turned 71.
I'm 65.
私はまだ20代です。トランス女性と称していた夫と離婚して3年ほどになります。
I keep wondering, what does he want from me? What does he want my room? Will he be satisfied then?
Abuse can happen. To any of us. He doesn't march through the town square in jackboots. It comes in quietly through the back door.
I took crumbs from the table. I didn't realise. I just wanted to be loved so much.
I started thinking, if he attacks me while I live, how many kids can I grab on the way out of the house? You know, will we all survive? Is he just going to murder me in my sleep because he's that angry?
We know what's behind this. We know what these men are like. We know what drives them. That's why so many don't want us hurt.
You hear about the women who stay. Some of them will now say that they're lesbians. The story of women that leave is hardly covered at all.
Every action he takes still affects my kids, still affects me, still affects our financial situation.
I would recommend that trans activists look at their behavior and ask how gaslighting and insults and death threats and rape threats square with their mandate to be kind.
My experience is valid. I know what I know. I've seen what I've seen. And you ought to listen to me.
In recent decades, men who wish to present themselves as the opposite sex have gained a huge amount of social recognition and legal support under the auspices of trans rights. Their stories, successes, and alleged victimhood feature prominently across mainstream media. Yet, there is a side of their stunning and brave journey which has not gained similar recognition, and that is the impact their choice has upon their partners and children. The film you're about to watch aims to tell the other side of the story. You will hear testimonies from the wives and children of men who transition. These perspectives are ones that many have been too afraid to talk about or were bullied into silence. Until now.
Before I moved in with him, he told me that he used to be a transvestite. You have to bear in mind that this was 20 years ago. So this was before the explosion of gender ideology. I said, well, what do you mean used to be? And he said, well, I haven't done it since I met you. And that was the start of an ongoing process of binging and purging, boundary negotiation, boundary violation, going up a staircase where the bottom of the staircase was that conversation where he said I used to be a transvestite, and the top of the staircase was him deciding that he was going to transition.
He was the youngest son. And then his father managed a mine. So he was quite masculine. He mostly wasn't home, but when he was home, he was drunk a lot. And in my ex's language, he had a heavy hand. And the mining town that he grew up in was full of this kind of machismo, this macho style of being that was so extreme that I thought they were joking at first when I came to visit. I was like, no, you can't want to be Rambo. This can't be real, you know? So he didn't really have any good role models as far as healthy masculinity was concerned. He began using the wearing of women's underwear for sexual gratification in his late teens. And when he first presented it to me, it was like, oh, it's a kink. And his story, the thing that he reverse engineered, was that when he was six, he put on his sister's knee socks and then he hid in bed so no one would find him. And he used just this one example from his past to explain how he's actually female on the inside.
This retconning of the past is one of the things that makes it really difficult for trans widows. And I call it the trans widow's conundrum. They didn't necessarily lie to you when you met them. They might not have told you the whole truth. You can accept that. What's really difficult to accept is them saying, well, actually, I was always like this. This is the person that I've always been. The person that I presented to you was a lie. And it's a really strange phenomenon because in order to justify their behaviour, they have to make themselves seem worse.
He's pretty open about his trauma, so I can talk about it a little bit. He was kidnapped and brutally sexually assaulted when he was a teenager by religious violent men who ran a troubled teen program. That sexual abuse, I think, led him to think a certain way about men and about himself as a man. It made him feel that the part of him that felt sexual was a violator. He thought of all sex as a violation after that. He felt like men were just gross and sexual and disgusting and insatiable. He just wanted out of his male body because he didn't want to be a rapist.
I suspected he had ADHD about halfway through our relationship. I noticed he had trouble concentrating on tasks that he didn't find interesting or enjoyable to him, and he over concentrated on tasks that interested him. He did get formally diagnosed after some years, and this makes me wonder sometimes if ADHD made him more susceptible to the current transgender fad.
I think a lot of people on the autistic spectrum feel dysphoric, but it's not gender dysphoric. They often feel like social misfits and tend to be very trusting and impressionable. So I think all of these things make people on the autistic spectrum easy targets or easy receptacles for transgender ideas. In his case, he was feeling lonely because he had gone to a different town to study. A friend or somebody said to him, you know, have you thought maybe you could be transgender or gender fluid and that could be the source of your problems, and said, you know, why don't you come to my house and try on a dress? And that's literally how it started. It was such a small thing was enough to have him thinking, oh, yes, here's something new. And then he made friends very quickly, which is something that Asperger's people really want, but they find it difficult.
Well, I invented the word autogynephilia in response to clinical interviews with a lot of gender identity patients. I would define it as a heterosexual man's propensity to be sexually aroused by the thought or image of himself as a woman.
Oh, I love being a woman.
True that I saw her hair like the branch of a tree. Willow dancing.
So being a woman is what's in your brain and what's in your heart, girl. You know what I mean? And your spirit. And your motherfucking spirit, bitch.
It is not about physicality. Woman is something far deeper and far more complex than that.
I would say that autogynephilic, let's call them symptoms, can be classified in about four different ways. One type I've called physiologic autogynephilia, which is fantasies or masturbation and enactments of women's physiological functions, such as breastfeeding or menstruating. Another class of autogynephilia I call behavioral autogynephilia, and this is behaving in ways that symbolize femininity to the patient. third variety is the idea of having a woman's body.
Wait. I have a really important announcement. I promise this will take 2 seconds, okay? You ready? They bounce. Am I right?
The last type of autogynephilic behavior I would call transvestic autogynephilia, of men dressing partly or completely in women's attire, which often starts out as masturbation accompanied exercise.
Girl, to clean up my room, girl, to do the laundry, girl, and in the bathroom, girl. That's all I really want is girls.
You know, Blanchard talked about homosexuals, transsexuals being one thing, and then you've got AGP males. I've always wondered if in between you've got men who just find it impossible to perform masculinity.
It's very hard to know whether there is a bona fide third type, because many individuals of the autogynephilic type have all kinds of motivation, both to lie to themselves and to be dishonest with other people.
He changed his story a lot. Sometimes it was, oh, I always knew. And sometimes it was, oh, I've just discovered this after so many years of marriage.
Some of these men, and Blanchard joins in with them, have speculated that it's just a form of heterosexual attraction turned inward, or it's a target location error. And all of this just completely erases the fact that these men aren't in rooms by themselves, because a paraphilia will escalate, and they will always bring, as it escalates, they will coerce other people, their wives, their children, their students, anyone around them.
I 100% sympathize with the viewpoint of these wives. I agree with those women who complain that their plight has been ignored in all of the stunning and brave celebration of what's happening.
You just don't know which version of reality to believe. You know, your own or theirs, which changes. You've got all the rest of society believing their changing version, but everybody can't be wrong. And you have to start thinking, well, yes, everybody can be wrong, and other women like me can be right. But it's very strange to have all of society telling you that your husband is actually worse than he presented himself as, and that's supposed to be a good thing. It's observable within all conversations about trans widows. You spend more than 50% of the time talking about the men and why they do it. Essentially, I don't care why they do it. I care about the women affected.
I think what's not being talked about is so many of these men, their frame of reference for what it is to be a woman is based on particularly brutal pornography.
The kind of porn he watched was, I found a lot of pictures of what looked like teen girls, but may have not been actual teens, but they were meant to look like teenagers. And then I found a lot of men that look like women. It was all extreme. It was such a shocking experience.
One thing that's very important about the society of the spectacle is that once you separate yourself from the body, the stimulation you get from the outside, the spectacle has to always get greater and greater because it gets boring. This is one reason that pornography keeps getting more and more extreme, because when someone interacts with pornography, they're not interacting with a living human being. Other beings are infinitely complex, and so you don't ever have to get bored, because there's always more stuff you can learn in a relationship. But if you're interacting with something flat, if you're interacting with pornography, it has to get more because it just gets boring.
Beginning around the 1950s and 1960s, BDSM-themed magazines featuring men dressed as women began to appear in the United States. One such example of this is Letters from Female Impersonators, which was being published by Nutrix, the very same company that was also putting out bondage, erotica, and pornography of Betty Page at the time. In Letters from Female Impersonators, men submit photos of themselves dressed as women, usually in underwear, sometimes in bondage. Within some of these letters, you can clearly see this escalation starting from social contagion, or maybe they have heard about this practice from other men who did it. And in some cases, they have said that it motivated them to begin cross-dressing in public full-time.
I went to check my Facebook page one night, and I used his laptop that was in the living room, and I went to get on my account, and I noticed that an account was already open, and it had a female profile and a female name. And then I looked a little closer and realized that it was his account. He was talking about our sex life and how boring it was. Well, after I found his Facebook page, I went and I searched through the house, specifically the room that he had his computer in, because I thought there's no way there's nothing. Where I thought there were spare computer parts and what have you, I started pulling out lingerie, clothes, shoes, sex toys. It was a sizable pile. I found a lot of gay websites where you would meet other gay men. And then I found different female names that he used on different websites. I found pictures of him dressed like a woman. And he put videos of himself on there dressed like a woman.
I had a sixth sense that something was not right. He was going out to the gay clubs by himself until the early hours. We're talking 5 o'clock, sometimes 8 o'clock in the morning. I knew something was up and I got on his computer. He was dancing with other trans people in ways that I thought were really inappropriate, totally not okay for a monogamous marriage. He was kissing other people. He was posing really suggestively with kind of older men. From what it looked like was about to go on after they put the camera down, I was pretty confident that he was cheating.
He would just go off when he wanted to do some of his filming or meet like-minded men. I didn't know then that he had a separate premises where he could live quite comfortably and indulge in his interest in pornography. There were lights set up as though, you know, filming was going to happen any moment. Makeup, thousands and thousands of photographs. I just had the breath knocked out of me at that time. I couldn't at first take it all in.
Now, there are a variety of pornography genres that are associated with the transgender movement and even have been implicated in the desire to medically transition, particularly for men. One such genre is known as sissy hypno, which is short for sissification hypnosis.
This is so funny that I'm describing my porn habits to the New York Public Library. JOI being jerk off instructions, so like where the woman is telling you what to do, like breaking the fourth wall. It is a radical feminist's worst nightmare. Like I would get in bed with my girlfriend, turn out the lights, we'd go to sleep, and then I would go to the bathroom and look at sissy porn.
Because if you talk about this, you're ruining the fiction, and the fiction is very immersive for the trans-identified person. It's really precious to them. And so the narrative of the family members or the loved ones becomes forbidden. It becomes something that you're not allowed to say.
I strongly believe that pornography is spreading a social contagion of fetishism and especially body modification fetishism among men. This is the most extreme form of misogyny because it reduces women entirely to objectified parts and to pornography itself. It is utterly dehumanizing and it is devastating women's rights on a massive scale.
When we were together in the beginning, there was definitely intimacy. You could tell he was emotionally connected as a man. But when he was dressed, he was immediately kind of sexually aroused. He was very interested in his reflection in the mirror. And as his feminine persona began to completely take over our sex life, he discovered a taste for a particular practice that many trans widows say their husbands ask for in order to feel submissive or something. And eventually these kind of behaviors were all that he really wanted during sex. And if I wanted to have any sexual intimacy at all or any sexual activity at all, I was pressured to participate. So he did this without so many words, but there it was, right? You're essentially frozen out if you don't do what he wants. No compromise, no worries about consent.
元夫は男とはまともに戦えないから女性になりたいけど、男性器で女性と性行為するという自称での心は女性でした。心は女だからレズビアンを言い訳にしていたのがさらに最悪です。
He was happy to use a strap-on because he believed that this was an activity that lesbians engaged in. I was offended when he referred to the glands of his penis as a clitoris.I didn't want to be the handmaiden to his bringing his inner woman into being.
And then he tried to say that I am a closeted bisexual and that if I would just be honest about my sexuality, that we could stay together. And I said, I'm not bisexual. I'm straight. And you're not a woman. So why would I need to be bisexual to stay in this marriage?
You have to understand, he's a 6'4" man. He's notfeminine. He's wearing women's lingerie, which he would have to change several times in the course of a sex session, which is how I thought of them. I did not think of them as making love to my husband or lovemaking at all. I thought of them as these sort of sex sessions as if I were a prostitute.
I had had surgeries during our marriage, and I never took the painkillers. And he eventually told me that he took them beforewe had sex, and he would refill prescriptions and continue to do this because he had to be in some sort of altered state of mind in order to have heterosexual sex with me. And I felt like a body, like it didn't matter who I was in bed. He wouldn't specifically say, I'm the woman now and you're the man, but it was heavily implied and it to the point where I didn't feel like I had a choice.And he was like a different person to have sex with too. Like he was a stranger. And I would ask him to stop and he would not stop. Or he'd want to do something that was painful to me, but he didn't seem to care.
One time we had had a sex session in which he didn't wear women's clothes. And afterwards he said, was that hetero enough for you? And I thought, what does he mean by hetero? What about the sex that we just had was hetero?And I think it meant because he didn't dress up. On the one hand, it's just clothes. Who gives a shit? But it's not just clothes, right? I would come downstairs in the morning and see him sitting on the couch, wearing the woman's lounge gown, drinking his coffee, reading the paper. And it felt to me like he was having a tete-a-tete with another woman, which was, of course, the way it had begun to feel in bed.It was like he brought another woman into the bed and said, I love her, you need to love her too.
You know when there's a corner where the wind blows and all the leaves collect there? Like, I think those marriages where the man transitions and the woman doesn't want to play along with it,that's where the worst things in this whole mess get tangled up and held in that woman's inability or refusal to deny everything about herself and everything about her life because, you know, she matters too. She's a human being too. She has a story too. And yet that's all regarded as secondary. She's just a supporting actress. You know, this man has been on this hero's journey. He's reinvented himself. He's come out like a phoenix or a butterfly or something like that. And he's now this beautiful woman. And there's this fucking bitch who is saying, no, that's not my story. This is my story too. You know, I married a man. You fathered my children. And she has to be silenced.
I lived with quite a lot of people who said that they were women. They didn't have a clue what a woman was. These were objects.Of an obsession, of a fetish. But the thing about objects of a fetish is you're only interested in them as objects. My father treated both his wives so incredibly badly. I mean, just mean. What I saw was really a hatred of women.
They do not care about what happens to women when it comes to this ideology. And clearly, they don't care.What happens to kids, but they well know what they're doing. They know they're causing harm and they don't care. They're vindictive misogynists.
I just watched that movie, The Silence of the Lambs. I thought it was pretty good. I did feel bad for Buffalo Bill, though. People are too mean to Buffalo. Yeah, I'm not saying that I endorse skinning cis girls to build a woman suit. But I get it, right? I wanted to kill cis girls for way less than that, right? No problem. Right? Yeah.
The number of times someone says, why would a man humiliate themselves like that, go through that to be a woman if it wasn't serious? Because to men, being a woman is a humiliating thing.
In a marriage where your partner started to use drugs or cheated on you, you would find therapists and support groups and other women who would say, this is not your fault. But on this topic, people are very quick to question whether or not you responded to it correctly.
It didn't take me long to end the marriage, especially after Jack physically assaulted me for not affirming him. My son and I moved out of the family home and couch surfed for a few months. After a couple of months of couch surfing, we found a rental to call our home.
He'd get home and he would just start yelling and yell for hours about all the ways I'd failed him. And then it got to the point where if a kid touched something, he would take their hand and smack it on the table. He blamed me and said my lack of good parenting has forced him to take more action.
Over time, he had me convinced that I was mentally unstable and too far damaged to be fixed. It took me months after the separation to see that this was mental and emotional abuse.
And a lot of times abusive partners will tell their spouse, for example, that, you know, that she's worthless or that she's not intelligent or that she doesn't understand something. And we're all susceptible to being influenced by what people say to us, all the more so when it's an important person in our lives. And if we're only hearing that voice, only that person is telling us repeatedly that we're, you know, we don't understand or we're stupid or we're worthless, we start to believe it and we don't have another voice of, say, a friend or a family member counteracting that in any way.
I used to write a lot. I would keep a lot of journals and I really believe in the healing benefits of just writing out your thoughts. He would read my journals. He would find them and read them. And so I stopped keeping them. And when I stopped keeping the journals, I let go of my grounding. But when I stopped doing that, and then I would say to him, this thing happened. He'd go, no, it didn't. And hearing no, it didn't enough times without anything to go back and say, yes, it did. Look, I wrote it down. I know what my memory is and I can trust it and I can trust myself. I let that go. In letting that go, I just allowed myself to be manipulated little by little, more and more, because I just wasn't sure, well, maybe my memory is bad.
You know how these men break women into parts to use for their sexual arousal. So they do the same, they break down their partners. They will break down grasp of your own sexuality, they will break down your mental health, they'll break down your reality, they will break you down. It's just as they like to break women as a whole down in parts. That's what they do to their partners. So these women have suffered abuse.
Shortly after baby's born, the baby in particular, but the baby and the mother together become a real focus of attention. She might just be beginning to nurse, and there's a lot of support that women need as they're going through this early postpartum period. They need help nursing. It's difficult and often painful in the beginning until the pair get a rhythm. And, you know, there's a reason why domestic violence actually usually gets worse during pregnancy And we don't know exactly why that is, but I suspect it's partly because there's so much attention being focused on the woman as she, you know, becomes more visibly pregnant and then immediately after birth too, that she's kind of the center of attention for people. And for the woman, the baby becomes her center of focus, and the man often feels, you know, kind of left to the side and unimportant. So I have seen cases where someone claimed a trans identity during the wife's pregnancy or immediately thereafter. And it strikes me that part of that may be a reaction to feeling you're not the center of attention. You don't even necessarily count that much anymore because it's all about the woman. It's all about the baby. So to have a partner who's claiming that he's going through this change of identity, to have him claim that he's the mother, is really to rob that woman of this needed time.
It's almost always when something big happens in the relationship where the man's no longer in the center of attention, that's when these inner women come out. So, for example, common themes are having a child, losing a job, or even sometimes the wife receiving some serious medical diagnosis. He wants to be called mummy. He wants to take that away from me. How far will he go to erase and replace me? I keep wondering, what does he want from me? What does he want my womb? Will he be satisfied then?
Initially he said to me, oh, the children will have to know that they now have two mothers. And then I just looked at him and he said, oh, maybe you wouldn't want that. So I would say, if you're now a woman, are you going to do the washing up? Are you going to wash the clothes? Are you going to vacuum the floor? Are you going to stay up all night when the babies are crying? Are you going to be the ones to make sure they have the right packed lunch for school and do all of those things? No, no, it's just all about the sex and all about wearing nail polish.
So one time my oldest wanted something I couldn't do. And she picks up the phone and goes, Mom, hey, is there any way you could pick me up early from school? And when she hung up, I go, you called your dad Mom? She goes, yeah, Jamie said that we have to call her Mom, especially in public and in bathrooms, or she could be in danger. Somebody could like call the cops on her for being in the bathroom as a mate. Like, we can't call him Daddy. And I said, how do you feel about that? And my oldest went, whatever, I don't care. And I asked the youngest, how do you feel about that? And she goes, it's kind of weird, Mom. And then like a year later, he's dropping off the kids and he says, oh, girls, you forgot something. Here, give this to Mommy Jenny. And I go, what? And then he sped off. Then later that weekend, my youngest called me Jenny. And I turned around and I go, I am cool as shit. But you are 10 years old and you ain't calling me Jenny. You're not calling me by my first name. And she goes, oh, I'm sorry, Mommy Jenny. I go, no, not even Mommy Jenny, Mom. And she goes, but it's how I keep it straight because Dad's Mommy Jamie. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, you can be whatever you want, James, but quit inflicting on me.
He also tried to breastfeed the baby. I told the doctor that. I said I was distraught and I thought that was totally over a line. And she said, I can't discuss another patient, but went on to tell me, well, and I said about him prancing around. She said, well, it's cosmetically very good.
The man's trans identity really starts to run the show. It becomes the center of gravity in the relationship and everything is second to that. Certainly asking the kids to call you Mom if you're a man is really putting your own needs first and not considering how that might be influencing your kids psychologically. So you're essentially using your children to validate what is in essence a sexually motivated need.
Mothers and babies are, we call them a dyad, so they come in a package for two of them. And that is because breastfeeding is a continuation of pregnancy, And lactation is the function. It is the ability of a woman's body to make milk. We're now moving into a situation where we've tried to make breastfeeding language so inclusive that we're now starting to exclude mothers because we do not use mum or mother as a term anymore. We talk about the gestating parent, the birthing parent, breastfeeding families, chest feeding, body feeding, human milk feeding.
It's very, very important that infants are given developmentally appropriate, consistent, predictable care and intervention and other supports, nurturance, broadly speaking, so that nature can take its course. And its course is for the infant to progress, for the infant to grow and learn and develop.
Anyone who is interfering in those early days can undermine the breastfeeding relationship between a mother and a baby because they're so reliant on each other. It's a really intricate feedback loop. Somehow, we have ended up in a place where men also try to induce lactation.
Now, a transgender woman's milk is just as good for babies as breast milk. That's according to a letter from the medical director at University Hospital Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. The claim was made as part of a response against campaign groups. The trust referred to studies and the World Health Organization guidance, including one case which found what it called no observable effects in babies fed by induced lactation.
What we can see from the science of it, the baseline of what would be in a trans mother's blood is going to be about the same as what is in a cisgender mother's blood.
What concerns me so much as a child of a transitioner are these future children who become props. I'm really interested in how these hormones affect a baby and what happens to this baby once the sexual joy of having a pregnancy is over.
He tried my clothes on. And so when the kids, some of them grew, I worried that he would try some of their things on while they weren't there. He buys them underwear. He's bought all the kids their own. Well, not my son, but all the girls' underwear because that's one of his fetishes, where it seems like a nice gesture. Part of me wonders why he's doing this and not buying them shoes. Well, in our divorce agreement, it said that he is not allowed to have anything sexually, you know, in front of the children. No movies, no personal sexuality in front of the children whatsoever, meaning that he couldn't come out to them. When my oldest was 11, she came home and said that he told her that he wanted to be a woman. She didn't want to go back to his house. He was angry that she was upset. He kept insisting that she come back. CPS got involved because I called them and said, I don't know what to do anymore.
The separation is probably, it's difficult enough on young children, you know. But on top of that, there's another layer. His father's not just separated, but also changing, transforming into this other person. The confusion it must create, it's just heartbreaking. There are no long-term studies done of children, of transitioning parents. So we just don't have any idea about the impacts this has on children.
I also don't think it's healthy to ask kids to disavow what they see in front of them, their knowledge of material reality, to have to assert something that doesn't reflect what is just simple consensual reality, that their father is a man. I think that that's disorienting, is confusing.
You know, a child who lives with a mother and a father knows which one is the mother and which one is the father, and that's like a really fundamental fact. And to suddenly be told that you have to rewrite that, I think, does great psychic violence to a child. I mean, it's really gaslighting.
So, you know, the extent to which a kid might be kind of recruited to be a cheerleader for a transitioning parent, you know, brings up this other issue because, the kid probably doesn't feel like they have a choice. You know, they have to kind of get behind dad as he begins his transition and, kind of become the flag bearer for this movement. So if a parent is a narcissist, they're going to tend to see their child as a narcissistic extension of them, where the needs of the child get eclipsed.
I lived this very quite sheltered life, really, in some ways. And then I moved to this situation where there were a lot of people who were cross-dressing and, you know, selling sex. There was a guy who was a prostitute. He'd left a wife and two little children to sell sex. He moved in with us for like 3 months. We lived in a tiny flat. He was very nasty to me. And I had expressed to my father that I didn't want him to be there anymore. And my father said to me, if you make more of a fuss about this, I won't love you anymore. You know, and this was, oh my God, I was what, 14? Anytime we were with anybody, I couldn't say anything that was in any way negative about my experience, about my father, about anything. And I couldn't question anything at all, despite the fact that my father made up stuff. My father would be angry with me, not so much that I attacked my father, but that I was kind of letting other transsexuals down. I would say that we'd had a very, very intense relationship during my teens in which he completely dominated my life. Half the things I said were things that my father had said. And I developed quite early on in that process a huge eating disorder. My father tried to starve me, so I would go and I would find other sources of food. I'd just go out and buy food. And I'd binge eat and things like that. I had metabolic syndrome. I had PCOS. But of course, that couldn't be recognised because going to the doctor for anything was something that my father didn't want to happen. Because really, he didn't want there to be any acknowledgement that there was anything wrong with me at all. There was no way I could have seen a therapist. There was no way I could have had any kind of help. I wasn't even diagnosed until I was at university, simply because he couldn't fail as a parent. Every lunchtime at the weekends, we'd go to this particular gay bar. And it was really, really nice. But I remember I was 13 years old. The bar had closed and everyone had gone into a room at the back. And we all sat down and we all watched I Spit on Your Grave. People passed dope around and I got smoke, a bit of dope. And people saying, it's so good, you know, your mother allows you to do this. I was never sexually abused in that situation. But I think there's a mental thing that happens where transgression is normalised. When I look at children in the media, that's often in the front of my mind. You've got to pretend that it's all okay. You cannot admit that anything is wrong at all. These weird fake smiles on these kids' faces in news articles. I can see it because I have the same fake smile. It just doesn't reach your eyes. You have to realise that your dad has fallen in love with himself and there's no part for you in that, where you're not just a prop. You're a child and you have this attachment to your father that you're always going to love him, right? Always. And then it's like this person came along and said, you know how you had a dad? Well, that was all a lie. And all that time, your dad didn't like being your dad. And my dad was kind of replaced by this other person. This other person who didn't love me like my dad loved me, right? Wasn't interested in me in the way my dad was, and whose love was conditional. It's like my dad died when I was 11, but I didn't realise. And I've been mourning him for 40 years. what you see is initially there's the divorce. He wants control over the woman, so he wants custody. He wants to see the kids. There's a power thing that goes on, but he's not interested in the kids. He's not interested in seeing the kids because he's now validating and going on and doing this other thing. So the interest in the old family dwindles.
I would like to write the stipulation in a prenuptial agreement where if you suddenly discover that you are getting caught up in cross-sex ideation and we have children, I will have full custody of the children. And you will have visitation only if you have had psychological evaluation.
For several years, at least 4 years, he had the kids 1 week and I had them 3 because he was going out all the time, living like a single person. And here we are broke trying to live with 2 households, you know, to rent. We battled for probably a year, 6 months. That was why our divorce wasn't finalized because I wouldn't get 50-50. And he said, are we really going to have to go to court over this? And I said, yeah. He goes, we're going to waste all our money. It's going to cost us 20 grand a piece to get a lawyer and fight about this. And I said, yeah.
I have a DVO against my ex because he physically assaulted me. However, the law doesn't extend that protection to our child because the ex only attacked me. With regard to custody, the fact that he was violent towards me has no bearing.
He sued me for custody of all the children after 8 years of our divorce. So he had left us when my youngest just turned 1. So he went through a whole year of back and forth. And then we got a guardian ad litem to talk to the children. And so I had to fill out a questionnaire. The very last question was, why do you feel that your ex would not be a good partner or a good parent to your children? And so I took that question seriously. And I wrote a good 10 pages of reasons why he would not be a good parent. And so it never made it to court because if he lost in court, he would lose all custody. So the day before we were due in court, he dropped the case. I did not have any idea that he was going to sue. It was an incredibly difficult year, thinking that someone would believe his lies and I would lose my kids.
To know what you are and to lead someone down the garden path into marriage, a mortgage, children, and know that you're living a lie to yourself, that's cruel. And there's a lot of talk about how trans widows who go through this just got with a really bad guy, like a typical abuse victim. So thanks for the empathy for that. But my question to that is, why do we keep hearing hundreds and probably thousands of women in the near future telling such similar stories?
元夫は遠くに住んでいた人でした。東京の私の元に引っ越してくる際に、そこでの仕事は辞めて、無職からのスタートになりました。一緒に住むからには生活費はゆっくりでもいいから払ってね、と約束をしました。元夫の仕事はなかなか決まらず、なんとか始めたアルバイトも、女性としての就職活動をしたいを理由に、ほんの少ししか働きませんでした。そのうち私の方が職場のストレスでダウンしました。その時、私が働くから専業主婦になりなよと言われました。私は感動して職場に結婚するので辞めますと啖呵を切って退職しました。しかし退職金は2人分の生活費であっさり消えました。私は普通は女性が働かないような日雇いの仕事をしながら自分の就職活動を始めました。その後たびたび、絶対にお金は払いませんと今までの生活費の支払いを拒否してきました。私が死にそうになって働いて、体も心も壊していたというのに、元夫は女性として働くことにこだわって。
It's not easy being a single mother. I juggle my career and caring for a toddler all by myself.Financially, I'm significantly worse off. He drained our accounts with his erratic spending, especially towards the end of our relationship.
When we first got married, I was the only one working. he sat at home watching porn. When he was finally working, it financially made more sense for me to stay home with our kids. Like, even though I wasn't sleeping and I was pregnant or nursing for 6 years straight, and he never once woke up for a feeding or any of those things, and I did all the house stuff. Like, we separated out by sex stereotypes. And I'd see bills coming in from our bank account from makeup companies and clothing things, and he said he had to have these things. I couldn't buy diapers and, like, you know, pads at the same time. I had to make choices like that.
I had a good job in London, and because I had a toddler and was on maternity leave, we had to decide what we were going to do. So we moved for his job, and in that city they've got a very active LGBT group, which is part funded by the government. And every Saturday he was going off to play squash, I thought. And in fact, he was at a tea party where they were teaching him about cross-dressing and passing. And I'm sitting at home, pregnant. There was not a chance I wanted to rescue that relationship in that way. But I had nobody else. I was pregnant, I had a toddler, I had no job, no security. And I found out, to my cost, no friends.
I had one friend who stuck by me. He tried to sell me a story that she made a sexual overture to him. It was a last ditch effort to try and separate me from my very best friend.
I never got the chance to seek support, because then at that point they were frustrated I hadn't told them, or, you know, they were just so in shock that they, like, it just, so he negated my entire support system immediately upon doing that, because that had been his intention the whole time, to keep me isolated and dependent on him.
In modern social justice movements, there's a hierarchy. And it's the hierarchy of victimhood, and victimhood is the same as virtue. So the more you're a victim, the more virtuous you are, and there is nobody who's more of a victim than the trans person. His transness overshadows everything else he might do, because he's the perfect victim, the eternal victim, the totally virtuous one.
I read a thing recently, actually, about the people who pretend that they have a disability, like the people who blind themselves or cut off a limb. And that the motivation is they want people to look at them and see them as people who've overcome something, see them as victims, but brave victims. And I think that's how my father wanted people to perceive him. I think there's a lot of links here about wanting to change how people see you. So, for example, my dad made up having polio as a child. He never had polio. But he told everybody that he had had polio. And so, you know, polio came with it a great deal of suffering. It was very painful. It could disable you throughout your life. Why make it up?
The social narrative is that transgender people are constantly targeted, so unjustly treated, denied even the most basic human rights. The narrative is even that they're killed regularly. When you look into it, none of these things are true. Jack put me down regularly. He threatened to unalive himself on more than one occasion, saying his only options were to live as a woman or not live at all.
He got an appointment at the gender clinic at one of the cities closest to us, and he went through one hour-long appointment. And after that, he was diagnosed with gender dysphoria. But before the second appointment, he decided that he wanted access to hormones. And he went on to some trans message boards, and it was essentially what to tell the doctor to have them prescribed quickly. So he mentioned casually to me before the appointment that he was going to tell the doctor that he was thinking of self-harming, and that he had read that that would help speed up the process.
こんな風だったのに、セックスしようとしてきた元夫に、私がやめてと言うとすぐに、じゃあ死ぬとか、どうせ受け入れてくれないんや、自殺するしかない、やははははなどと言ってきました。
My job is, I'm the program director of a suicide prevention program in Georgia. He knows damn well that when he acts suicidal,
that I teach the warning signs. So he would pull them on me to try to keep me to not leave him. It was the severest form of manipulation. Whenever he felt like he wasn't getting enough attention, he would send me a link to an article about how higher rate of suicide in transgender it is than anyone else.
The woman who's in my shoes is the one who keeps it together for the children. And the emotional crisis of that individual who engages in cross-sex ideation, that is the priority. And there's this whole narrative, which I call suicidal posturing. All of that suicide talk just needs to be handled differently, basically the same as any other kind of suicide talk.
Anybody who really works in suicide prevention does not give themselves the grandiose ego that we can save lives, because we can't. I knew that I couldn't save him, but I also knew that I didn't want my kids to lose a parent by suicide the way I did, because that's the worst thing possible for me. Yeah, he loved that card. He played it every chance he got.
If you are in a relationship that is abusive in some way, you feel such shame about it. And you expect that anyone that you talk to about it is going to say, what are you doing? Why don't you just leave? And trust me, a lot of women in abusive relationships sort of say that to themselves every day. They already feel beaten down and terrible about themselves. And so talking to another person who's going to just say, well, I don't understand, if it's so terrible, why don't you just leave? Just makes them feel worse.
Why didn't you leave sooner? Why did you put up with that? I suppose what they don't realize is that they don't march into your bedroom wearing fishnets on the day that you meet them. It's gradual. And they wait until they're secure in the relationship, until the woman's invested, before they reveal those things about themselves. People want to find what's unique about us that makes us susceptible, and also be able to congratulate themselves if they're not like that. So they can say, oh, well, it wouldn't happen to me, because these are a particular type of women, broken women. I object to that, and I don't think that it's an accurate representation of trans widows.
I've seen very intelligent, competent, strong women get involved in relationships where, due to a kind of slow accumulation of influence in a certain direction, she eventually kind of lost herself temporarily.
I know that some trans widows believe that the one thing that we might all have in common is empathy. Our exes work out that we will put up with their behaviour. I think there's some legitimacy to that argument, but I would argue that because of female socialisation, all women are socialised to be empathetic and to be accommodating. So even if you say it particularly happens to empathetic women, you're still back to the point where that's all of us.
I feel that he was profoundly at fault, but that maybe he was in the grip of something that he wasn't really able to control. And if that was the case, then I can, up to a point, forgive him. What I can't forgive him for is entering into the relationship in the first place, because he knew and he did it anyway.
Jung said that fanaticism is always the sign of a repressed doubt. So when I see someone being fanatically happy, especially about something that's really complicated, I always assume that there's quite a bit of repressed doubt. For a woman to assert that she's just thrilled about her husband's new identity and that she's very happy now being, his lesbian wife, especially, you know, if she has young children, for example, and she's completely dependent on this person and her world's been turned upside down once by having a baby and maybe again by her husband now saying that he's a woman, I have to assume that there's a lot of mixed feelings there. You couldn't imagine that it would be otherwise, that there would have to be a complex reaction to that. And she may really love him and really hope that it's going to work out, So she's trying to convince herself that it will be okay and that she's happy. She wants her husband to be happy.
It happened to be summer, and there's pride parades all over. And I encourage him to go to one of those and meet people. In that week that I was trying, he was off meeting all these people. He was excited. I was not allowed to tell anybody. So I was devastated. I was grieving. I was confused. I wanted to be supportive.
When I was young and quite naive, I thought it was something that I might be able to deal with. And I don't mean transition would be something that I might be able to deal with, because that wasn't on my radar. An occasional cross-dressing hobby might have been something that I could deal with, because I can remember thinking, well, you know, there's worse hobbies. At first I thought, okay, I loved him and I was in love with him. And it was presented to me then as that he wasn't doing it anymore. But then, of course, he started doing it again.
We're married. We have four kids. We have good jobs. We have a house, a life. You know, maybe I should try to live with it. Maybe it's me, and I'm just not open-minded. Then he would get on me about how I should. And I thought, some people are just like this, and I'm not perfect. Why wouldn't I give him a pass on a lot of these things? Because that's what people do. That's a marriage.
If you're in a relationship with a really violent, abusive partner, it is dangerous to leave. And the most dangerous time is when women try to leave. So that's a statistic, that if you're in a violent relationship, the time you're most likely to get killed, for example, is when you try to leave. So it's very important to understand that women often stay because it's dangerous. Women have a right to need things. Women don't have to set themselves aside in a relationship for any man, no matter what his circumstances. It's important to be reminded of that, because unfortunately, the culture has been doing a pretty good job of telling women otherwise.
Like many other women who've been in my situation, of course I tried therapy, couples and individual. All the mental health professionals we saw were all too happy to affirm him. What was needed from me was acceptance and tolerance. I really struggled to find a therapist who wasn't wrapped up in the gender ideology.
The first counselor that we went to for marriage counseling, there was no mention of the cross-dressing or the dressing or the trans identification. And he fought with her the entire time. And then he made multiple remarks about how she had great legs and was a MILF. The one that was the worst, though, for our relationship issues, and this was with trans stuff occurring, and she was very cold, and I've honestly never had another counselor like her before or after. My mental health was really beginning to suffer from the erosion of my boundaries, and she said that the reason that I was feeling bad was because I was trying to control the relationship, and that my anxiety stemmed from the fact that I was too controlling.
I went to the doctor and said, look, I'm so depressed, I really can't cope with this. And she looked at me, and I was obviously very upset. She said, what you need is some tranquilizers to calm you down. Lots of women enjoy this as part of their sex life. I went to the gender clinic down the road, and they saw me for 10 minutes and said I should just get over it and carry on.
Search of archives reveals that the Agony Aunt type newspaper columns have been giving exactly this kind of advice to women with cross-dressing husbands since the 1960s.
In 1965, Dr. John Ollivan published Sexual Pathology and Hygiene to be used as a manual for psychiatrists. In this book, he introduced the term transgender in order to distinguish between transsexualism and transvestic fetishism. Interestingly, Dr. Ollivan then goes on to discuss the wives of these men who are engaging in transvestic fetishism, And he encourages psychiatrists to do everything in their power to be sure that she doesn't leave the relationship. For example, he says, if the patient is married and the wife has accidentally discovered his abnormality, sometimes it must be the physician's most immediate concern to do everything to keep the marriage intact. The wife must be dissuaded from packing up in a panic and taking departure. The milder cases among single men, if fairly adequate sexually, are perhaps best advised to seek marriage. In each case, the problem of whether to advise the bride beforehand of his chronic deviation requires thought. So he is saying that men whose wives leave them will often then start to act out their fetish in public and their condition will worsen. So he's recommending that these men stay involved in relationships with women to act as a buffer for their condition, but also as a buffer from acting out in society.
The only thing that I found was an email group back in those days, a Yahoo group, and it was the Women of the Beaumont Society. The Beaumont Society, as far as I'm concerned, now was set up to gaslight wives into accepting the unacceptable. It was actually my ex that directed me to that, and I didn't really relate to the stories of the women who were in it, because there were either older women in really teeth-grindingly miserable relationships with cross-dressers, or young women in what I now know to be abusive relationships with other gynophiles.
What I'm aware of with the Beaumont Society was that I was aware that it was an organisation for transvestites, but really I think it was an organisation that arranged kind of parties for transvestites to go to where they could cross-dress, to normalise it for their wives, like create these kind of, you know, groups that wives could get involved in and things like that. You notice now the Beaumont Society is a trans society, just trans. Now that we've lost the transsexual transvestite thing, all of those people who were transvestites, sissy porn people, are now considered women.
It's really, really difficult to build online support networks because we've got the constant worry that it's going to be infiltrated by our actual exes or by their supporters because they don't agree with what we're trying to do. Any vetting process is really time consuming and not infallible. So making connections with other women is really, really difficult.
But see, that's a problem in this whole fight against gender ideology is people say, you know, you've got to focus on the children. We've got to save the children. The feminists, they're over here doing this, but we must focus on the children. But we can't protect the children if we don't protect their mothers. If women can't talk about our experience and talk about protecting our kids, then the kids aren't safe. People don't seem to connect those things, you know.
Wir können nicht irgendwo uns treffen und darüber reden, offen darüber sein, wie das so ist für uns, wie schwierig das ist, damit umzugehen, weil dann gelten wir direkt als transphob oder sonst irgendwie als verabscheuungswürdige Menschen. Und das ist natürlich ein großes Problem. Deswegen bin ich auch froh, dass es die Trans Widows gibt, wo sich die Frauen zusammengeschlossen haben und dagegen vorgehen und ihre Stimme erheben und sagen, hallo, uns gibt es auch noch, wir spielen hier auch eine Rolle und wir haben auch was zu sagen und wir lassen uns hier nicht mundtot machen, unsere Sprache verbieten. Daher bin ich diesen Frauen sehr, sehr dankbar und bewundere sie sehr für das, was sie tun.
I was lucky enough to make friends completely by accident with another woman who had gotten a divorce from a trans-identified male who was very disturbed, much more violent. And we spent weeks just kind of unloading our stories on each other. And it's been so invaluable.
Talking and connecting with people who are grounded in reality has been really helpful. It really improves my mental health and mental stability.
It often feels though that our stories are just whispers in a storm. You know, it's so important to be seen by other women. It's made a huge difference to my mental health and my confidence, and it's undone a lot of the gaslighting that I was exposed to in the relationship.
So I'm not exactly putting a trans pride bumper sticker on my car, but I'm also
very open about it because I've processed it. I've told my story so many times in therapy and support group that when it comes up and I am forced to face it in public, I don't fall apart in tears anymore because I have built a scar around it and a toughness around it. And I mean, people are forever saying, God, you're handling this so well. And I was like, not if you saw me in support group, because I'm a blubbering mess. And that is where I pour all my pain out in the only place I felt comfortable in.
There's a quite strong movement in academia and law to remove any concept of sex altogether. So to have birth certs that don't state what sex the baby is. This is almost too stupid for me to be able to say it, but it really seriously seems that people like this think that if we never name sex, there will be no sexism.
El efecto de introducir a un hombre en la categoría de víctima de violencia de género, que según nuestra normativa solo puede ser una mujer, tiene el efecto mágico de sacar a los hombres de la categoría de agresores. De manera que lo que en España llamamos violencia de género solo puede cometerla un hombre contra una mujer, pero no una mujer contra un hombre o una mujer contra una mujer. Estos últimos casos, si se dan en el contexto de una relación afectiva o familiar, serían considerados violencia doméstica. Y bueno, esta distinción es relevante en España entre violencia doméstica y violencia de género, que en otros países no existe, porque hace unos meses tuvimos un caso que podría ser lo que en sanidad se conoce como caso centinela, que es un caso que nos alertó de las posibilidades que había la nueva normativa. En septiembre de 2022, una mujer que fue a denunciar a su pareja hombre por violencia de género se encontró con que él había cambiado de sexo legal sin que ella lo supiese. Cuando la mujer fue a la policía, se enteró que las provisiones legales iniciales a las que tendría derecho como víctima de violencia de género, como una orden de alejamiento del agresor, por ejemplo, pues a ella no le podían ser aplicadas porque ahora legalmente estaba denunciando a una mujer. Así que la policía lo que le dijo es que el caso iba a ser tratado como un caso de violencia doméstica, que es una disputa entre una pareja de mujeres lesbianas.
In the UK, well, in England and Wales anyway, as part of the Gender Recognition Act, there's what our opponents have very successfully made a propaganda campaign on and called the spousal veto, and what we reframe as the spousal exit clause. When a man decides he wants to transition, he applies for a gender recognition certificate and he's married. We have provision where if he's married, the wife either has to consent to the marriage continuing formally or is able to annul the marriage or divorce before the gender recognition certificate can be issued. In the meantime, an interim gender recognition certificate is issued that can be used as grounds for annulment. The reason that's important is for women who, for religious or cultural reasons, aren't able to divorce. It gives a mechanism to exit the marriage via an annulment. It's also really important because for all of the women involved, it means that we can legally exit the marriage before its status changes to a legally same-sex marriage. We frame it as the spousal exit clause because we're looking at it from the perspective of the person who wants to leave. It provides an exit route from that situation. They've spent years and years and years misrepresenting the law and arguing that it means that we can stop them transitioning, that it's a terrible infringement of their civil liberties. There's this myth of the abusive trans widow, there's never any evidence of, who want to trap him in the relationship and that this provides a mechanism by which she can do so. It doesn't, because it can be used by either party as means to exit the marriage. Why create this myth? Why spend so much energy misrepresenting trans widows' rights? The political motivation is that it stands in the way of self-ID because they can't get the gender recognition certificate until the wife's either agreed or ended the marriage.
When we go to court,
Are we allowed to call our father he? When we're talking about abuse, are we allowed to talk honestly about our father? What we're finding there is that the dad can control you through the courts, because your dad can force you to say that he is a woman by using the court system. Some reason, it's now okay to go and change a child's birth certificate. So this is the historic record of your birth can be changed by your parents. And this never used to be the case, but now it can be. I deserve accurate paperwork. We all deserve accurate paperwork.
Ja, da muss man mittlerweile aufpassen, ob man da überhaupt noch neutral überhaupt beraten wird. Das stelle ich mir vor für eine Frau, die sich trennen will, weil ihr Mann plötzlich behauptet, eine Frau zu sein, dass das für die Frauen auch in Deutschland gar nicht mehr so einfach ist, dass dann dadurch die Frau in die Rechtfertigung kommt, zu erklären, warum sie nicht mehr in der Ehe bleiben will. Nicht der Mann erklären muss, warum er eine Frau ist, plötzlich nach x Jahren Ehe oder...
Groups like Scottish Trans Alliance and Stonewall now define in their definition of domestic abuse against trans people, refusing to affirm your husband's gender identity as abuse, trying to encourage them not to transition is abuse. Trans widows are being stitched up right from the very moment that their husband tells them that he identifies as trans. Any response that isn't positive and affirmative is now labelled as abuse by us on them. It's a frightening situation to be in.
You know, people who are meant to be all about safeguarding become actually the opposite of safeguarding. People who are meant to be about free speech become all about silencing. And I think it's because there's a lie at the centre of it. It turns everything around as you have to try to patch things together to try to hide the fact that there's a rip in the fabric of reality that you're trying to conceal. And I think that's one reason why institutions like politicians, charities, campaign groups, companies and so on are just not doing the most straightforward things they're actually paid to do. So in the future, if this continues to go on, we will continue to be living, breathing mammal beings, but we won't have the words or the legal structures or the societal structures that are needed.
All of these things are this perfect storm to create this perfect storm of body hatred and perfect storm of woman hating that comes together, that's been building for thousands of years, really.
You know, we'll be in this weird post-human future, but we'll still be human. So the world will be even less suited to the sort of creature that we are than it is now.
I am a woman of colour and my ex is Caucasian. It has crossed my mind with everything that has happened whether he held some resentment towards this. And I say this because in the early years of our relationship, we discussed race and sex. My ex would vehemently argue that there is no such thing as racism and sexism in the Western world. He would very quickly invalidate my view, saying that I'm being too sensitive and overreacting. Now that he identifies as a woman, he claims transgender people are so oppressed and so discriminated against. Just makes me wonder if he was jealous that I had some sort of social oppression points by being a woman of color, and he had none by being a white man.
So we are a Muslim family. As you know, Islam has specific rules about men and women and marriage. And so when he turned around and said that he decided he was transgender, this obviously wasn't something that I could just absorb and say, oh, okay then, because he's changing the very foundations on which the marriage was based and what we'd agreed upon.
The statistics from our website show that we're consistently at the top of Google searches for trans widows. what's been really surprising from looking at the website traffic is just geographically where a lot of these women are. Countries like Russia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, you know, that makes me think that women are going through this all over the world. When AGPs are fetishizing women's oppression, you have to ask yourself, is it even more likely that they're going to be fetishizing it in countries where women are even more oppressed? Which is quite a horrifying thought, but I put money on it being the case.
Tokyo で一人暮らしの女性は、ジェンダークリニックに通うために近づく地方のトランスがいるから気をつけてください。警察も法律もどうにもならなかった。だからこそ、身体的女性には身体的女性のみで構成されるスペースが必要なんだと思います。
I had a conversation with a journalist once about that, and I particularly remember her saying to me, oh, do you think he's happier now? And I said, well, A, I don't know, and B, I don't care. And C, why are you asking me this? If I said, oh, he left me for another woman, you wouldn't say, oh, that must have been difficult for him, and is he happier now? Well, I wouldn't be expected to care.
I wish the lawmakers and media editors recognise the destruction it causes families. If there is abusive behaviour within these relationships, they need to be suitably punished, not be given a free pass just because they're transgender.
When it comes to newspapers and what sells newspapers and what gets clicks, I think a man standing there in, you know, stilettos with fake breasts is obviously going to get more clicks, more attention and sell more papers than, you know, the abused wife in the background.
I want the press and the academics to appreciate that at least 50% of their attention should be directed towards us when they think about this, rather than 100% of the attention being directed towards our ex-husbands.
Well, the hypocrisy is what gets to me, right? Because on the left, it's axiomatic that the untold stories will be told. This particular untold story, no one wants to hear.
I suppose we're just Nazis, right? We don't have souls or hearts or identities or feelings.
Pronouns are supposed to be reflective of identities rather than material reality. The truth has really been bent to cave to these men's desires. There are also, of course, trans-identified men within newsrooms, and indeed some have been employed at major newspapers as sensitivity readers. So now sometimes a copy will be read by somebody before it goes out, just to check it's not offensive. So it's clear that lobbyists are looking for incidents to manipulate, to utilise, to sort of push their worldview.
With religions such as, say, Judaism and Islam, where men and women operate in quite separate physical spaces, it's very important that the synagogues or the mosques address the issue of transgender. Because, say, for example, you're on the women's side of the mosque and a person of male appearance walks in and sits down and says that they are a woman. What is going to happen in that situation? Does the mosque have a position on it or not? All the people who are protected under the Equalities Act should be taken into account before any changes are made that favour transgender people.
So I would like to ask why my abusive ex-husband's feelings are more important than my lived reality. Just an answer for that would be beautiful. They'll dance around it because no one wants to admit that's exactly what they're saying.
Where is the justice? They're supposed to uphold justice, and they're actually sanctioning abuse. And women have fought for equality for so long, and now we're being told, no, you're being transphobic, you're being unpleasant, you're being whatever.
Do they know anything at all about autogynifying men and the problems that they pose to the privacy, the dignity, and the safety of women and children?
You know, it's not just the emotional impact, though I think that's really, really important to talk about what it's like to be a child in this situation. There's a political aspect as well. All we're asking for is equal treatment. Equal treatment. That if you're listening to the AGPs, you've got to listen to us as well.
The one that sits at the heart of this sorry state of affairs for me is just this. Why are they not listening to the voices of women? Why?
I ended up on Mumsnet, and what I said on the thread on Mumsnet was, I've been through this fairly recently and come out the other side of it. I know that there's other women around here who have been through it and or are going through it. It'd be good if we could support each other. Women found it really helpful to have a means of peer support that was independent of trans organisations. So there wasn't an agenda that women had to stay. There wasn't necessarily an agenda that women had to leave. We've had regularly people plopping onto the support threads on Mumsnet and calling us bigots. The thing that they always attack us with first is, how dare you call yourself trans widows? It's so disrespectful to actual widows. And for some reason, trans widows are the only group in society who aren't allowed to self-identify. This is what we've chosen to call ourselves, and it's enabling us to find each other. If people don't like the term trans widows, then, you know, that's on them. So I felt like there needed to be a hub, and I think of trans widows' voices to a large extent as being like a hub. It was a simple idea where we have a website, women can tell their stories, and people can read their stories.
Kate and Jenna's son, Brody, he was talking about his father, and he said Twitter just slammed him down. And this had a kind of like, even though it seems so silly, but it had a visceral reaction. I was like, you know, because I thought, this is a child talking about his dad, right? He's allowed to freaking say what his dad is. He's allowed to use his language to describe his father. And I thought, is it possible that what I experienced and my thoughts around this could be helpful in this debate? So I set up this website. I started blogging. And the first thing I wrote was the pressure to pretend it's all okay. I got an email from someone telling me that they wished I'd die of brain cancer and some really, really horrible things. You're a child. You're talking about your parents. And somebody comes in and says, you can't say that. Why not? We're actually writing to politicians. We wrote about the GRA. We're talking to Parliament because we really want to state a case for us, for children transitioners, this very, very minority voice that is completely unheard.
This is what liberation means. This is what empowerment means. It's us and a microphone finally speaking the truth.
I don't often speak to people, but I've become open and honest because I was actually threatened by a neighbour. I said I was going to complain to the government that they were paying for my husband to cheat on me. And a very nasty man came up to me in the street and threatened me and said, don't you dare. We all need to speak.
If people choose to be horrible to me and to insult me and call me names, then so be it. I will not be silent about it, not for my sake, but for the sake of women everywhere who are being silenced on this subject. I'm speaking out for those people.
And you know, people have criticized me for talking about their father in this regard, but you know, it took a lot for me to get here, and I took a lot of things into consideration, and I watched as my kids were swallowed up by this and getting to be extremists themselves. And I thought, I really have to say something so people understand how an autogynephile, if you want to call it that, or a paraphilic man can affect a family.
There's a rhythm to every social justice movement. It tends to start with a few people who are either unusually brave or else people who have really nothing to lose speaking out. And that at first is painfully slow, because every person who does it pays a very significant cost. And other people see it and they think, oh, I better stay silent. But as the numbers increase, the cost goes down and you start to feel not only that you're not alone, but actually you won't pay too big a price for speaking, so more people speak up, and then it accelerates. Every woman now who's paying a high price is doing it for her sisters and for the future.
One of the best things that's come out of the experience is that I know what it feels like to have to lie to myself and how that can just eat at your soul and diminish you so much. I want to tell my story because I just want to make it count if I can spare someone else what I went through because they get out earlier. Doesn't make the pain I went through worth it, but it certainly makes it useful.
There's a pretty famous line from a thriller, which is the first one through the door always gets shot. And I was not the first one through the door, and I wasn't the 10th one through the door. I wasn't the 100th, but I still got shot. And the thing is, there's enough of us going through the door now that it's time for you to go through the door too, because there's enough of us, and at some point, we're going to be able to stop them.
The only way we will make change is if we speak out, is if we act, is if we stop playing along with these abusive men. And that's something that we each have a responsibility to do.
I hope that this coming up hard on against the contradiction that is trans ideology can bring enough women together and give them the impetus that they need to recreate the world so that it's fit for women.
There is nothing you can be or do that will make you the object of his affection. He is the object of his affection. He wants himself as a woman, and you're just a mirror. You're someone for him to look at and validate the fetish.
The sooner you leave, the sooner you can begin to heal. It's easy to talk yourself, to rationalize yourself into something that later you very much regret.
What I regret is continually adjusting my boundaries in order to try and make the relationship work.
It's really hard because I think most people, when they're in it, can only hear what they can hear. Taking the benefit of somebody else's experience and advice, it's not an easy transfer. Get out now. Feminizing works on them like an addiction. They're like addicts in the grip of a high. They keep chasing the next high, and nothing outside of that life will matter to them. And that includes you. You may be of use to them, but you mean nothing to them.
Protect yourself and your children. Nobody deserves to be used and abused mentally, physically, emotionally, financially, or sexually.
Don't let him isolate you. If you're not willing to leave, at least tell someone. You need a friend, you need a family, you need a therapist, you need an outside perspective, and you need outside support.
Our exes have got the rest of society saying yes to them. That undermines the impression of themselves that they're trying to give to the rest of the world.
So you need to, as soon as possible, try to find support for yourself, from people who understand what you're going through, and don't be coerced into anything, because it will only get worse. And don't be embarrassed, because the embarrassment is not yours. The embarrassment is theirs.
自分自身の財産と生活を守れないのに、他人の踏み台になろうとしては絶対にダメです。いくら自分のことを価値のない人間だと思っていても、誰かのおもちゃになる必要なんてありません。男に振り回されて生きる必要なんてありません。
This too shall pass. I cannot tell you how much happier I am now than I ever was in my marriage.
If it went on for a number of years, I used to beat myself up, so I still do to some degree, but you know, I have children with this man. But you know, before you beat yourself up, look at what happened to governments, medical institutions. Everyone has been captured. It's not just you, so you can't blame yourself. And you also have to trust yourself.
This might seem as though it's the end of everything for you, and it might seem as though it's the end of your life, everything you had or believed you had, but it isn't.
You are as important as your father is. Don't let yourself be squished by this process. I think also talk about it and talk to adults, and not necessarily the adults that your father wants you to talk to.
J.K. Rowling has like a quote that rock bottom is a great place to launch off from. That spot down there, that is the spot where you get to recreate and redefine what's important.
Even if you go through these terrible experiences, you can use them. It sets a bomb off in your life, but you can come back to something that is even better.
things are on the turn. Things are getting better in my view. More and more people are realising what trans widows have been through and want to support us.
I like to think that I'm still breathing at the end of it. I know that's an extreme one, but no matter what happens, we'll still be breathing. And I think with the kids, no matter what happens, the kids and I will be together. It doesn't matter if we have no money or if he's thrown something else at us, or if I think for a moment that things are impossible or they're going downhill. Nothing's impossible. I didn't know how in the world I was going to manage with four little kids, but we made it. There's always people that have been through the same thing as you or that can help you. It made me feel less alone. I had more of a backbone than I thought I did. I mean, now I'm proud of myself for making it all the way through.
It's better on the other side.